Thank you very much. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to give this seminar today. And as Alice just said, I'll be talking about this loop-corrective zero-source symmetry of 4D quantum gravity, which was a paper that we published earlier this year. This was done in collaboration with Dan Kopetz, Anna Maria Reclero, which are two other students of Andy and Andy Strominger. And this paper is part of a series of papers that Andy's group has been focusing on over the last several years. And it's about this triangle of equivalence between soft theorems, asymptotic symmetries, and the memory effect. Each of these subjects has been studied extensively for the past half century or so, but it wasn't until fairly recently that it had been noticed that they might be three corners of the same triangle or three sides of the same coin. For today's talk, we will not be focusing much on the memory effect. Instead, we will be looking at this equivalence between soft theorems and asymptotic symmetries. And the goal is to use something we know about soft theorems and learn something we don't know about asymptotic symmetries. Let's do a little bit of a history lesson regarding what I will be talking about today. In particular, I will be using what is known as the subleading soft graviton theorem, which was first introduced in the seminal paper in 2014 by Cacciazzo and Strominger. In that paper, they conjectured this theorem and then showed it to be true at tree level. A couple months later, a paper by Kopetz, Lysov, Pastursky, and Strominger, they showed that using the subleading soft graviton theorem, you can obtain the word identity that is associated with the with a asymptotic symmetry group of asymptotically flat Minkowski space known as superrotations. And superrotations essentially generate a Virasoro symmetry on the asymptotic two-sphere. This Virasoro symmetry, of course, hints at a CFT structure of these correlators on this two-sphere, and it would be interesting to study a little bit more about what precisely this CFT is. The first step for doing so was done in this paper that came out late last year by Kopetz, Mitra, Reclero, and Strominger, where they were able to write down the tree-level stress-energy tensor for this CFT. Of course, now that we have the tree-level part, the natural thing to do is see if we can write down what is a one-loop correction. So the goal of the presentation today is as follows. What are the tools at our disposal? We have the subleading soft graviton theorem that was conjectured by Cacciazzo and Strominger in 2014, and now it's been shown to be on much more solid theoretic grounds. There were papers by Byrne and friends where they also show that you can get this subleading soft graviton theorem using gauge invariance alone. The subleading soft graviton theorem implied a Virasoro symmetry on the asymptotic two-sphere at null infinity. And associated with this Virasoro symmetry is the fact that these correlation functions in 4D Minkowski gravity can be recast as correlators of a 2D CFT. And this 2D CFT, we now know what is its tree-level stress-energy tensor. So what would we like to do? Well, we would like to derive the one-loop correction to the 2D stress tensor, which before this paper was previously unknown, using the one-loop correction to the subleading soft graviton theorem, which was known. So that is our goal. Now, how do we want to proceed to get to that goal? We will start from the beginning. We will assume that the audience is perhaps not familiar with the soft theorems. So we'll first review the tree-level leading and subleading soft graviton theorems. We will then construct the 2D stress tensor at null infinity, and this will also be at tree level. So the first half of the talk will be tree level, and this is results that you may already know. So if you want, you can go to sleep, and then I'll try to wake you up for the second half of the talk, which is regarding things that we don't know. The second half would be the quantum part of this talk. We will begin by reviewing the one-loop IR divergent correction to the subleading soft graviton theorem. And finally, we plan to use this to derive the one-loop correction to the 2D stress tensor. So that's the roadmap for today's presentation. Are there any questions? Okay, good. So let's start at the beginning, which is a leading soft graviton theorem. In particular, because we're interested in how these soft theorems relate to the asymptotic symmetries at no infinity, we will in particular be focusing on massless particles only, because massless particles are the only things that reach no infinity. What does the leading soft graviton theorem say? It says that essentially what it does is that it relates the matrix element of a Feynman diagram with an external soft graviton insertion to that of the same diagram without the external soft graviton. That's a lot of words, but it's probably most easily illustrated using a picture. So here we see, let's just focus on this diagram for now. We have a scattering amplitude in gravity, and we have a bunch of these external legs going out that's carrying momenta. And here we have this wavy little line here that's parameterized by Q. This wavy line here is what we call an external soft graviton. And when we say it's soft, what we simply mean is that we're taking the limit in which the momenta goes to zero. So we're taking the Q is going to zero limit. The soft graviton theorem then tells us that we can relate this scattering amplitude to the original scattering amplitude without the soft graviton multiplied by a universal factor. And usually this universal factor can be determined using Lorentz or gauge invariance alone. Now, over here I have two diagrams, and these two diagrams are simply illustrating the two ways in which you can attach an external soft graviton leg. One way is to attach it to one of these outgoing particles, and another way is to attach it to one of these incoming particles. You may be wondering, well, you know, I can also attach this soft graviton to one of these internal lines inside the blob, but I will demonstrate in the next slide, or rather, I will claim, and you'll have to believe me because there's a calculation involved, that attaching the soft leg to an internal line in these diagrams will not give a contribution to the leading order for the universal soft factor that we will obtain once we factorize this diagram. Okay, so in equation form, let us assume all particles are outgoing just for simplicity. If we include incoming particles, then we will have another term that looks like this on the right-hand side with a minus sign because the momentum is incoming instead of outgoing. This is the content of the leading soft graviton theorem. Here we have the n plus one particle matrix element. The plus minus here is just a helicity of the soft graviton. And we're taking the limit of Q goes to zero, which is the momentum of the soft graviton. And on the right-hand side here, we have the original matrix element without the soft graviton. We have the momenta of the other n particles. Epsilon mu nu here is the polarization of the soft graviton. And kappa here is the gravitational coupling constant. The first thing to note is that this universal factor here is order 1 over Q. So in the limit of Q goes to 0, this is a divergent correction, or a divergent factor. And this is precisely the reason why we don't need to worry about attaching the soft graviton leg to one of the internal lines. Because if you do so, after you do a quick computation, you'll notice that its contribution is order 1 at most, and hence it will not contribute to this leading soft factor. Another amazing thing about this equation is that this is actually tree level exact, which means that we don't need to do any loop, the inclusion of further loop diagrams will not alter this equation. And the reason for that is because kappa here is a dimensionful parameter. So with each additional loop that you include, it will come with a factor of kappa squared. And it turns out that in order to make units consistent, it will also come along with a factor of Q suppression, which means that at one loop order, the contribution of soft factor would be something that goes as order 1 instead of order 1 over Q. Hence, again, it will not contribute to leading order for the soft factor. Okay, so that is the leading soft graviton theorem. But we can also consider the subleading term. Georgie, do you have a question?
So just a very naive question.
Okay.
So you're assuming that kappa is small, but much larger than Q.
Yes.
In this thing. Okay. Mm-hmm. So is the actual expansion parameter in your perturbation theory kappa over Q?
You mean when I look at the soft? Yeah. So there's actually going to be two expansion parameters in here. One will be in terms of kappa, and this will be the loop expansion that I will be talking about later today. And one expansion will be Q. So at tree level, I might be answering your question in about two slides, but essentially at tree level, we have the order 1 over Q term here. But in principle, there's also an order 1 term and an order Q term, which I will write explicitly in about two slides. Yeah, there are two expansions in terms of soft, and in terms of small parameters here that's going on. Good. Okay, so the leading factor goes as order 1 over Q, but the subleading factor is order 1. What about that? And the subleading soft graviton theorem is essentially has to deal with this order 1 piece. And the claim, of course, is that the subleading factor is universal as well. And this was shown to be universal in the paper by Cacciazzo and Strominger in 2014. Now, if we include the subleading piece as well, then what we have is, which is what we will call here, instead of the leading soft graviton theorem, we will simply call it the soft graviton theorem. And at tree level, we can write the soft graviton theorem in this form, where S0 is just a leading soft factor that we already saw a couple of slides back. And S1 is a subleading soft factor, where here it also includes JK, where this is the angular momentum of the kth particle. And we also have plus order Q. So for exactly the same reason why the leading soft factor S0 here is tree level exact, the subleading term is one loop exact. And the reason for that is if we consider two loops, then every loop comes with an extra Q suppression, which means that at two loops, it will contribute to order Q at most. So in essence, once we determine the one loop correction to S1, we've in fact determined it completely to all loop orders. And I just want to mention in passing that if you use gauge invariance, which basically amounts to replacing epsilon mu nu here with Q mu lambda nu symmetrized, where lambda nu is any arbitrary one form, then we expect the matrix element to vanish. And if we impose this condition, then we will obtain both momentum conservation from the leading term and angular momentum conservation in the subleading term. Okay. So that's all I want to say about the tree level soft graviton theorem for now. Are there any questions? No. Okay, so now we are moving into the territory of asymptotic symmetries. Now, so symmetries are one of the most powerful tools that we have at our disposal, as you are probably all aware. And in a classical system, one way that we can think of symmetries in the most naive sense is that it is a field transformation that leaves the equations of motions invariant. If instead we're talking about a quantum mechanical system, one way to think about certain types of symmetries is in terms of a word identity, or in the sense that their charges commute with the S matrix. Adopting this standpoint, we can define asymptotic symmetries to simply be symmetries that act on the physical states in a non-trivial manner. Now, In many cases, these asymptotic symmetries are actually parameterized by functions that are local in spacetime. Therefore, we want to differentiate them from what people usually consider to be gauge symmetries, which are merely redundancies in the theory. So we will call asymptotic symmetries oftentimes large gauge symmetries to distinguish them from the mere redundancies in the theories. And we just want to point out that this definition of large gauge symmetries allows for topologically trivial symmetries as well. We do allow for these large gauge symmetries to be connected to the identity. Now, after we make this definition, you might wonder whether these large gauge symmetries are actually physical symmetries of the system. Unfortunately, we don't have a very good theoretical underpinning in regards to this question, and therefore we will adopt the operational standpoint and simply state that large gauge symmetries are physical if and only if it gives rise to a non-trivial word identity, if it gives rise to some constraint equation in our theory. Of course, this way of defining whether or not a large gauge symmetry is physical is a little bit unsatisfactory, and hopefully in the future we will, or someone will be able to come up with a more theoretically satisfying answer, because this requires us to check on a case-by-case theory, on a case-by-case basis for whether or not a large gauge symmetry is physical. And this brings us to the fact of this remarkable equivalence between asymptotic symmetries and soft theorems. While we cannot say that all asymptotic symmetries are physical, we can certainly say that some of them are. And this was established a couple of years ago when it was shown that many asymptotic symmetries are equivalent to soft theorems in the sense that soft theorems are simply the word identities for these asymptotic symmetries. And just to give an example, the leading soft theorem was shown, the leading soft photon theorem was shown to be the word identity for the asymptotic symmetry group in QED. And this was done in conjunction with Mitra Porphyriadis, I can never pronounce his name, and Strominger. And the leading soft graviton theorem was also shown to be equivalent to the word identity for the supertranslations in the BMS group, which is a symmetry group for asymptotically flat Minkowskis, for asymptotically flat spacetimes. And this was done in conjunction with Mitra, Lysov, and Strominger. Georgie?
So do you know of any of these large gauge symmetries which actually do lead to trivial word identities?
So we don't. But we can't rule them out.
Yeah, it's just a logical possibility.
Exactly. Yeah. There are many tantalizing hints that perhaps with every single asymptotic symmetry, it should be corresponding to some sort of soft theorem. But yeah, at this point, we can't say for certain. Yeah, I should mention one of the things that make this subject so exciting to work with is that it's at its infancy. So we work with, there's all sorts of open questions and things that we want to address that we don't have answers to just yet. And in some sense, this equivalence is rather surprising and remarkable, because soft theorems, they were first studied in QED in 1937 by Bloch and Nordseek, later developed by Lowe and friends in 1958, and then extended by Weinberg to gravity in 1965. And these were mainly particle physicists. Now, on the other hand, we have asymptotic symmetries, which appeared in the work of Bondi, Messner, Vandenberg, and Sachs in 1962, where they deduced the asymptotic symmetry group for asymptotically flat spacetimes. And these were general relativists. So on the soft theorem side of things, people were studying these using perturbative Feynman diagrams. And for the asymptotic symmetry side of things, people were using the asymptotic structures at no infinity to study them. So it's quite amazing that 50 years later, we are starting to understand that perhaps the mathematical structure behind these two seemingly very different subjects is actually the same. And perhaps part of the reason for why this equivalence has escaped notice for so long is due to the fact that the two subjects use very, very different notations. For instance, particle physicists, they like to write down things in terms of the momentum of the particles, the angular momentum of the particles. On the other hand, to study asymptotic symmetries, at least in the sense that the BMS did, it makes a lot more sense. It makes a lot more sense to use what are known as retarded Bondi coordinates. So here we have the radial coordinate r. We have the retarded time u that's going along scribe plus. And at each point in this Penrose diagram, it's a two-sphere. And the two-sphere is labeled by the complex coordinate, z and z bar. Using this notation, we can think about any 4D scattering process as a 2D correlation function on the asymptotic two-sphere at scribe plus or scribe minus. And the way we do so is the following. So we have a scattering matrix element here. And at now, because we're dealing with massless particles only, it has to enter the sphere at some point, and it has to exit the sphere at some point. So each time it enters the sphere, it enters at some location that's parameterized by z and z bar. Each time it also enters with a specific energy. So it's the energy is given by omega. So we can think essentially of these 4D scattering processes as these correlators involving insertions, operator insertions on the asymptotic two sphere. And this matrix element, of course, obeys the Lorentz symmetry. And Lorentz symmetry, it can be shown, is manifested as a global conformal group on the S2 in this language, where we can take Z to be AZ plus B over CZ plus D with AD minus BC is equal to 1. And this brings us to the subject of superrotations. What exactly are they? So the Lorentz group is manifesting itself as the SL2C acting on these correlators on S2. When BMS first studied these asymptotically flat spacetimes, they actually noticed that it's not these correlators do not obey just the SL2C global conformal symmetry. In fact, they obey the local conformal symmetry as well. And there's a full Virasoro symmetry that these matrix elements live under a representation of the full Virasoro group. However, the only well-defined vector fields on the two-sphere that are the only globally well-defined vector fields on the two-sphere are essentially the generators of SL2C. So for that reason, they threw away all the remaining Virasoro generators. Now, in 2003, in a footnote by Banks, and much more extensive work done by Barnack and Trousseau in around 2011, they said that perhaps we shouldn't be so hasty to throw out Virasoro generators that are not globally defined, but rather locally defined. Perhaps there's some content in them after all. And if we allow for the full set of Virasoro generators, this extended symmetry became known as superrotations. And the super part of this rotation has nothing to do with supersymmetry. All it's saying is that we're considering a generalization of the usual Lorentz rotations. Of course, you may be wondering, well, they do have isolated poles. Does it really make sense to talk about these superrotations? And regarding that matter, we can't say for certain, but we can say that the tree-level subleading soft graviton theorem implies a word identity for superrotations. And the tree-level subleading soft graviton theorem is something that is fairly well established now. So perhaps there is some content in these superrotations after all, and we should perhaps not throw them out. The fact that there's a Virasoro symmetry on the asymptotic S2 suggests that we can think of these 4D scattering amplitudes as the CFT2 correlators. And this hints at a holographic formulation of asymptotically flat spacetimes. And this is actually the original motivation for Strominger when he started this program to understand the relationship between soft theorems and asymptotic symmetries. Because if we can understand what the CFT is that lives on the asymptotic two-sphere, we would have some sort of 42D Minkowskian CFT correspondence. As a result, of course, then we would like to understand what this CFT is that is living on the two-sphere. And the first thing we want to do is write down the stress tensor for the CFT2. We do want to remark, though, that the CFT2 could be something that's very exotic. There's no guarantee that it is a unitary CFT. And right now, the only thing we can do is try to progress one small step at a time in trying to determine what the CFT exactly is. So in order to write down the stress energy tensor, we first want to recast our soft theorem in terms of an operator insertion statement. And to do so, let us begin by writing the soft factors that I introduced several slides back in terms of the Bondi coordinates. So here I've given the tree-level leading and subleading soft factors in terms of these Bondi coordinates. And as you can see, they look quite different from the notation that particle physicists are used to. So here, omega k is labeled the energies of the m particles. We have z and z bar labeling the position in which the soft graviton has entered the two-sphere. And zk and zk bar labeling the positions of the other hard particles. And here, let's see, gamma zk, zk, zk is just the Christoffel symbol on the S2. Hk here is a conformal weight, Sk is the spin of the kth particle, and omega Zk is the spin connection. Right. So the form of these is not important to keep in mind. But the interesting thing is that if we define two operators that look like the following form, where A and A dagger are simply the creation annihilation operators for the soft gravitons, and by soft, it's you can see that it's soft because we're taking the limit omega goes to zero. The amazing thing about, the thing to bear in mind about the two soft factors that we wrote down in the previous slide is that if we define two operators that look like this, then once we insert it into the S matrix element, it gives us precisely the soft factors out here. So you can think of these two statements here as the equivalent statement to the leading soft graviton theorem and the subleading soft graviton theorem. So let's just gain a little bit of intuition about these two equations. You may have noticed that here there's a limit of omega goes to zero of omega times the soft factor. But notice, remember that the soft factor has a 1 over q pole. And if we translate this into the notation that we're using now, where omega labels energy, the S zero here has a 1 over omega pole. So omega times 1 over omega simply tells us that this thing on the right-hand side is a non-zero finite answer. And similarly, if we look at the second line of this equation, we see that it gives us the S1, which is a subleading soft graviton factor. And this is due to the following, that we have this projection operator 1 plus omega del omega. What this projection operator does is that it projects out the 1 over omega pole. So for this reason, N0 is the, we call it the leading soft graviton insertion operator, and N1 is the subleading soft graviton insertion operator.
Can you comment on the fact that you don't have a commutator of N with S?
So it turns out that the commutator between N and S, so in order to make this properly well-defined, we also have to, everything I've been talking about is on Scry Plus. In order to make this well-defined, we also need us to formulate the analogous operator insertions on Scry Minus. And if we do that, then we can write down a properly well-defined commutator where we have essentially N0S minus S times the analogous quantity defined on the scribe minus. And it turns out that both of these terms give the same contribution. And so we can simplify that equation into something that looks like this. Does that help, or are you looking for?
Maybe the comment about why do they give the same contribution? What entity would be a commutator? So here, the fact that they give the same contribution goes deeper than just symmetry.
Right. The way I think of it is essentially in terms of crossing symmetry, that the outgoing positive helicity soft graviton can be seen similarly as a negative helicity incoming soft graviton. But that's the way I understand it. Maybe you're thinking about something in particular. Okay. Maybe we can discuss afterwards. Okay, now using this, the rule that we just came up with, that we derived for these subleading soft graviton insertion, we can then define an object that we're going to call suspiciously TZZ, and as it will turn out, this object is precisely the stress tensor at tree level that we're looking for. We can insert this expression into the S matrix element, and the result that we get after computation is the following. And this is precisely the form of a CFD stress tensor correlator on a curved background. One thing perhaps to notice is that the way that we wrote down this TZZ, this is actually a non-local stress tensor. However, once we insert it into the S matrix element, it becomes local. The people who worked out this stress tensor, unfortunately, they did try to find a local expression for this, but they were unable to succeed. So perhaps this is a hint that the sort of Minkowski CFT correspondence that might exist, it hints at something that's very different from the ADS CFT correspondence, where in ADS CFT, the stress tensor on the CFT side, you can write it down using the local bulk fields. Okay, now we can see how this stress tensor, how it generates local conformal transformations. So here we define it, TC here, as a contour integral over, it's parameterized by Y, which is a arbitrary local CKV on the two-sphere, where YZ, TZZ, and this contour will enclose all the operator insertions. And if we do the computation, we'll see that inserted into a correlator, it gives us precisely the transformation property we desire. These are the local conformal transformations for our primaries. So that's all I have to say about tree level. Now we want to move beyond tree level. So are there any questions before?
So if you move backwards, this was supposed to hint at a holographic theory.
Yes.
Each one of those O's was labeled by a position and a frequency. Mm-hmm. Did the frequency, is that in the weights of the conformal weights? Or
you can think of the frequency as living inside the conformal weights. So the conformal weights are given, you can express these, I can write it down. So HK is equal to 1/2 of SK minus omega K, del omega K. Lights. Does that work? Yeah, so the frequency lives here.
Can you just say in words what I'm looking at there?
Oh yeah, so to 1/2 times SK minus. SK being the spin of the particle.
Okay.
Minus omega K del omega K. Omega K times the derivative of omega K.
Yeah. Okay. So in your holographic theory, then, I suppose to think there's not a discrete collection of operators. There's sort of, for every operator, there's a continuum labeled by omega, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So it's an unusual, well, I guess we're looking for.
Yeah, it's something that's a bit unusual.
Okay.
But
T is the, I don't want to think that it's also the bottom of some tower of these operators. Like, it, Like if I have any other operator, what we just said is it's actually part of a tower or a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
And T though is an isolated operator, doesn't live in some family like that.
Right. So I'm not entirely certain. Right now, I think the only thing we know about this T is that when inserted into a correlator, it gives the correct transformation. In fact, you may be wondering, well, we've inserted one T, why not insert another T and then determine the central charge? Well, because these Ts involves this subleading, the subleading guy. And unfortunately, we don't know how to take double soft limits for gravitons, because at the subleading level, the order in which you take them to be soft is ambiguous, so you need some sort of prescription. We don't know what prescription to use yet. We don't know how to do insertions of multiple Ts even. Yeah, so right now this T is quite mysterious to us.
Is there a right, or is the philosophy there is a right prescription or different prescriptions?
There are
different.
Right, so there are different. My understanding is that there are different prescriptions. There has been people who looked into this where you can take, so definitely if you take one leg soft and then the other leg soft, it is what you get for the subleading soft graviton factor. It depends on the order in which you take them to be soft. There are also authors who have looked at what would happen if you take them both to be soft simultaneously. But right now, I don't think we have, I guess there's no reason currently to believe that there is a unique prescription, but if there is, we don't know what it is. Okay, so I guess I should. Okay, so let's now move beyond the tree level. So there are no corrections to the leading soft factor at tree level, but there is an IR divergent one loop exact correction to the subleading soft factor. Because of this existence of this one loop divergent correction, we have three different possibilities that can occur. The first possibility is as a stress tensor becomes anomalous. And what this simply means is that the superrotation, it's a classical symmetry, but it's not a quantum symmetry. And that might still be interesting to study, because sometimes anomalies are quite rich, and it would be interesting to study how this anomaly arises and whether or not we can learn something from it. The second option is that the stress tensor needs to be renormalized. It needs to have a one-loop correction. And after we perform this one-loop correction, then we get back the full symmetry. It simply means that the tree-level stress energy tensor isn't the whole story. And the last option here is that, well, the fact that there's an IR divergent one-loop correction, maybe it doesn't make sense to talk about these quantities. Maybe we should make sure that everything is IR finite. So those are the three options. And today, our talk will be mainly focusing on option two, that we can, in fact, get rid of this IR divergent one-loop correction so that when we insert this renormalized stress energy tensor into a correlation function, then we still get the correct transformation property.
Can I ask when you say anomalous, what does that mean? In that when I think of CFPs, I think of the stress tensor, there is an anomaly, it isn't quite
I see.
You're using the word in a different sense, though.
When I say it becomes anomalous, I simply mean that the symmetry is explicitly broken. I can't write down a...
When it
acts on the other particles, yeah. Okay, so to derive the one-loop correction to the stress energy tensor, let's first look at the one-loop correction to the scattering amplitude. And here we're just doing the usual loop expansion of a scattering matrix element. And all we are doing here is we're factoring out the kappa squared that comes along with each loop. Now, the one loop IR divergence for these matrix elements have been worked out, for instance, in one place by Byrne, Davies, and Nolet, and we'll be following vaguely their presentation of this matter for the next couple of slides. So here, they show that the one-loop IR divergence is given by sigma n over epsilon times the tree-level matrix amplitude. And epsilon here is a Dirac parameter, mu is a renormalization mass scale parameter, and sigma n is given by this summation over here. But now we've related the one-loop IR divergent piece to a tree-level piece. And we know how to take the soft limit of the tree-level piece. This is just a tree-level soft graviton theorem. So as a result, we can take the soft limit of the one-loop divergent piece, and after some computations, we get the following expression on the right-hand side. Now, if the subleading soft factor does not receive any one-loop correction, then we will only get this term up here in front, because this is just the tree-level leading soft factor plus the tree-level subleading soft factor. But the presence of these two additional terms on the right-hand side tells us that there's a one-loop correction to the soft factor. And as I mentioned here, the problematic terms, I probably shouldn't use anomalous, but the problematic terms are these last two terms here. Now, recall that we have the subleading soft graviton insertion operator, where if we insert it into the S matrix element, we obtain the following equation. Because the soft theorem, it gets a correction that's coming from those last two problematic terms, when we insert N1 into our S matrix element, it will also get a correction, where the correction is simply this operator acting on the two additional terms that we get in the soft factor. And this correction, one-loop IR divergent correction, propagates itself to the stress energy tensor as well, because the stress energy tensor is defined in terms of N1. So one loop correction to N1 automatically means that there's a one loop correction to TZZ as well. And that's simply given by the integral over gamma WW bar over Z minus W and DW cubed acting on the correction to N1. But over here, what we have is something that looks very messy. It involves a renormalization scale, it involves logs. In fact, there's no reason to believe that we can write this in some simple fashion. And the surprising part of this endeavor is that, in fact, the correction to TZZ, the one-loop IR divergent correction, is actually, it's a very simple integral over these quadratic terms in N0. And to be honest, we don't really understand why this one-loop correction is in such a simple form and why it's in this particular form. And remember that originally the correction has these terms, sigma prime n plus 1, where we have both these logs and mu squared. In this final expression, all these dependence on logs and mu squared has dropped out. And so it's actually very easy to see how this dependence on mu squared drops out. And the way to see it is if we just focus on pi dot q log mu squared term here, we can pull out the q log mu squared out of this summation. So what we're left with is just q log mu squared dotted with the sum from I equals 1 to n of pi. So by momentum conservation, this dependence on mu squared vanishes. So everything that we, if in fact, the dependence on log also drops out in momentum conservation. So the only thing we can say regarding this is that we know using momentum conservation, we can get the one-loop correction to TZZ in a very simple form. But beyond that, we don't have that much intuition regarding this, actually. But since we were able to write a one-loop correction to TZZ as simply an integral over these quadratic operators, we can now do a very simple redefinition of the stress energy tensor to account for this one-loop correction. We simply need to subtract out this offending correction and to redefine the stress energy tensor to be this T tilde ZZ object. And if we do so, then by construction, we have eliminated the one-loop correction, and we now have this following equation, where T tilde is a renormalized stress tensor. But this equation is actually, we have swept something under the rug. We are assuming that there are no IR finite corrections. Everything that we have been doing so far has to deal with the IR divergent correction. Well, of course, we should say then something about this IR finite correction. In principle, there should be one, and if there is indeed one, then the one-loop matrix amplitude has this IR divergent piece that we have been analyzing over the previous few slides, and then we have this finite piece that we have not said anything about so far. If we do include this IR finite piece, then the all-loop soft graviton theorem has this following nice form. So here, S0 and S1 are the tree-level pieces. We then have the one-loop correction, which is proportional to kappa squared. And these two terms are proportional to 1 over epsilon. These are the IR divergent corrections to the soft theorem. And finally, we have this delta finite of S1, which we have said nothing about so far. And recall, I just want to remind everyone that because the subleading soft theorem is one loop exact, this is true to all loop orders. Unfortunately, while I would like to say a little bit more about the finite correction, very little is known about the finite correction. And in all explicitly checked cases, it is actually zero. And this is done. This is work partially done by not me. This is a different He, Song He, Yutin Huang, and Kang Kao Wen. So there they checked low point amplitudes numerically and showed that indeed that the delta finite piece is it's zero. However. We will, for the time being, remain agnostic about its existence because there's no theoretic proof for why it should be zero. So currently there has been work done by Byrne and company where they seem to say that they expect this delta finite correction, the IR finite peak one loop correction to vanish, and they check it for some simple scalar loop amplitudes. But as of now, we're not aware of any concrete argument regarding to its vanishing. So we will simply make the weaker claim that our expression, so that everything that we have been doing so far, it's exactly true if and only if the finite correction is zero as well. Okay, so let's just summarize what we have achieved so far. We first determined the tree-level 2D stress tensor TZZ that is living on the asymptotic two-sphere. We then computed the one-loop IR divergent correction to the sublinear soft theorem. Using this, we were able to translate this one-loop IR divergent correction to the stress tensor TZZ. And finally, we discovered that this one-loop IR divergent correction is actually a simple integral over quadratic, over local operators, N0. So we can renormalize it by subtracting off this correction. And as a result, we now have a one-loop IR divergent corrected stress energy tensor. Now, we have certainly many open questions still, and the most pressing one is there indeed an IR finite one-loop correction? And if so, is it universal? If there is indeed a one-loop IR finite correction, then we will be back to the three options that we were looking at early on. The first option is, well, can we renormalize the stress energy tensor further by subtracting off the one loop IR finite correction in order to preserve the proper transformation properties for the stress energy tensor? And is this IR finite piece even universal? And if this doesn't make sense, then maybe we say, okay, well, maybe the correct things to look at aren't these IR divergent quantities. Maybe we should work in a scheme where everything is IR finite, for instance, in the Fadeev-Kulish basis. So currently, actually, one of the ongoing things that Andy is exploring right now is precisely this point where he's trying to figure out if we can reformulate everything in terms of IR finite quantities. And lastly, we would also like to try to figure out what happens when we insert a single factor of the stress energy tensor. What happens if we insert multiple stress energy tensors? For instance, if we insert two, then we'll be able to determine the central charge for the CFD. Unfortunately, because of the question that Rob asked, due to the non-commutivity of the soft limits, we currently do not have any ideas for how to approach this problem either. Okay, and so that is all. Thank you very much for listening.
So I'm wondering if the theorem on the boundary has some version of an OPE.
Sorry?
Is it possible to expand the boundary correlators in some version of an OPE?
Expand the boundary correlators in some OPE?
Right.
So that would certainly, so essentially what we have is that, let's see, did I write that? Right, so are you looking for something that looks, I mean, essentially, this would be something that's what you're looking for, right? This is essentially OPE between the stress energy tensor and the individual.
Yeah. Sure, insertion. But I'm not only looking for the OPE, only with the stress tensor, but the between any pair of two arbitrary operators. Like, if my understanding is correct, for any massless particle, you have a one parameter family of some primary fields,
mm-hmm. Yes.
On the boundary. So do all these operators satisfy some OPE?
I see. So you want to know if we don't have the stress energy tensor, we're just looking at these massless insertion operators. I see. I don't think we considered that because usually we think of one thing we always did was that we would take these S-matrix elements to be analogous to these correlators. So I guess your question is, what happens when you take two creation operators for these scattering particles, whether or not it has an OPE structure? I presume it does, but we didn't work it out.
But didn't you show that you looked at the S-matrix elements and mm-hmm. said that they had the structure of standard CFD correlators.
Yes.
So implicitly then, isn't his OPE structure there? It's just that you haven't unfolded it.
That's correct. That's what I mean. Yeah. It should be there, but we haven't worked out the details for where it should be. It would require some computation.
Well, I guess to show that you have an OPE, you should be able to put the CFD on other manifolds, right? on S1 time stuff. But at the moment, it looks like there's the structure is only there for, it's possible to define a theorem on S2, or maybe is it one S2 or two copies of the S2? So describe one S and describe.
It's actually one copy. The way we do, we account for both incoming and outgoing particles is, let's see, is in terms of the energy operator. So we, here. So we essentially we take energy to be positive if it's outgoing, and we take the energy negative to be if it's incoming. So then, in that sense, we only need one S2.
So what's the analog of Virasoro for higher dimensions?
That is something we have not worked out yet. This is explicitly for the 4D case. It has been shown that the soft theorem works for all higher even dimensions, but that's true for the leading soft graviton theorem. I'm not sure if the subleading soft graviton theorem has been worked out for all higher dimensions yet.
What can you say about the primaries of this CFD? I mean, you've just shown some explicit construction of the stress energy tensor, but mm-hmm. Do we know of similar explicit dictionaries for primaries? And in particular, is the CFD extremal?
It's a CFD extremal.
Meaning that its dual is just gravitons.
To be honest, right now we don't know very much about the CFD. We in fact almost know nothing about it. We don't know it's unitary. So I don't think I can answer the question for whether or not it's extremal.
Sure. But do you know anything about primaries, the spectral primaries at all?
The way that these correlators transform, they transform as primaries. So one thing that perhaps we can suspect is that the primaries consist simply of these massless particles in a theory of quantum gravity.
So each massless particle in the bulk corresponds to a primary of some sort?
Yeah, presumably. But this still needs to be worked out.
Was it obvious that the stress tensor remains traceless at the order that you're in?
The stress tensor remains traceless.
Like you looked at the correction to TZZ.
Uh-huh.
But was there a correction to TZ?
Oh, good. Good. There is a correction to TZ bar Z bar as well.
No, it's the ZZ bar.
Oh, I see. Is there a TZZ bar? Let's see. So I think the answer is no, because in order for there to be a correction to TZZ bar, it would involve something that looks like NZZ bar here, and with both indices lowered, and that is zero for asymptotically flat spacetimes. So I think as long as the fact that we're living inside asymptotically flat spacetime and that we don't perturb out of this regime, then I think it will remain, then TZZ bar will remain zero. Otherwise, then it can pick up some finite contribution.
Thank you.
Thank you.